This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
When our water heater broke down last month, it was a nightmare. It took 5 hours for the plumber to show up, and he charged us a couple of $100 just to come out. And then it cost another $1,800 to put in the new water heater. By the time it was all said and done, I felt like I'd been taken. But what else could I do?
The smartest thing you can do is get a home warranty from American Residential Warranty. Their home warranties pay to repair or replace all your major appliances when they break. And they will break, and at the worst possible time. Call American Residential Warranty right now for free information on home warranties starting at just pennies a day. Don't wait for your refrigerator to stop running or your ceiling fans to stop turning. Call American Residential Warranty right now. Ask how you can save up to 50% on washer and dryer coverage. Just call 1-800-686-3910. That's 1-800-686-3910. Again, 1-800-686-3910. Call now.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you for joining. We're going to start up with a Buck Brief today.
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
The battle for Aleppo is underway. The largest city by population, or at least it was, in Syria. The economic center, the most important city in Syria's north. And the heart of the anti-Assad, non-ISIS resistance is in Aleppo. And currently, they are encircled. They're encircled by a combination, a coalition not of our making, but one brought together by Putin, by the mullahs in Tehran and Assad. You have Russia, Iran, and Syria all acting in concert to take the city of Aleppo. They have it surrounded, and there are a number of major strategic implications, as well as the possibility of a humanitarian catastrophe right now, all of which prove that this idea that Russia was going to get bogged down in yet another Afghanistan-like situation, as they did when it was the Soviet Union, those are not true. In fact, Russia is showing that it is possible to put together allies and air power and take territory in Syria. In fact, the New York Times has a headline recently that Russian intervention in Syrian war has sharply reduced U.S. options. You see, while the Obama administration has been sitting back and either trying to wait this thing out or relying on diplomacy, saying, as a matter of conventional wisdom, that there is no military solution to this conflict, there is only a political or diplomatic solution to it. That may not be the case. We may be approaching something of a turning point. Perhaps there's a ceasefire in the future, but if that ceasefire comes, it will only come after the non-ISIS anti-Assad fighters, the so-called moderate rebels, have been largely stamped out. In some cases, perhaps even starved out or having fled across the border into Turkey. Russia has managed to help Assad break the stalemate against the anti-Assad forces, against moderate rebels, who are the main target of Russian airstrikes, which tells you a lot, doesn't it? The Islamic State blew a Russian airliner out of the sky, leaving from Sharm el-Sheikh on the Sinai Peninsula, killing hundreds of Russians, and yet the primary target still of Russian airstrikes in Syria is not ISIS, not Raqqa, but the moderate rebel factions that could be an opposition force that we would use to depose Assad. They're a threat to Russia's buddy, to the Assad regime, to the Alawite client state that Russia uses as its proxy in the region. And so they're the primary target. And the airstrikes the Russian Air Force has been able to engage in have made a difference on the ground. It's changing the lines of control. It means that Syrian forces have been able to advance. And also, of course, Iranian-backed militia, Hezbollah from across the border with Lebanon, they are all in this as well. So this notion that it's impossible it's impossible to use increased external air power in order to try and push back a force on the ground in Syria. The Russians are able to do it somehow. You'll notice that our allies, in many cases, at best in Syria, we've just been able to give them enough air cover to prevent them from being overrun. It was only after a long and protracted fight we were able to help the Kurds keep the city of Kobani near the Turkish border. But this situation right now playing out in Aleppo is major. And the fall of Aleppo would be a disaster. It would be a disaster for a number of reasons. For one, it would mean that there is no real resistance against Assad that is not jihadist in nature inside of Syria anymore. The Kurds aren't looking to overtake the rest of Syria, and you have to have some Sunni Arab force on the ground. This is what you hear from all the presidential candidates. They say this as though they're the first person to state something so obvious, which is that, yeah, it'd be great if we had a Sunni Arab force to do the fighting here. But if Assad is able to continue encircling Aleppo, and this siege, which could turn into a protracted one, and there are even some who say that this is a humanitarian catastrophe in the waiting, they might starve out some of these rebels. If the siege is allowed to continue as is, the Assad regime's hand will only be strengthened. Now, this is changing the balance of power, not just inside of Syria, but also regionally. As you know, on one side of this table, you have Assad. You have the Syrian regime, such as it is, which is now on the offensive and is taking back territory and has encircled Aleppo in the north. You have Hezbollah, which is a Shia militia in Lebanon that has the backing of Iran and works closely with Assad. They've been involved in this fight. You have Iranian support and Iranian intelligence assistance and Iranian special forces. Whatever Iran can do to help the Assad regime, it is doing. And now you also have Russian air cover and whatever special operations and whatever covert things Russia is willing to do in order to help the Assad regime. So you have all of this playing out right now on one side, but they're not the only ones with a stake in this whole situation. You also have regional Sunni powers, not necessarily Sunni Arab, but you have Sunni powers that have decided they're going to do more now. You have the Saudis saying they're going to deploy troops in Syria. They've said this now. They're willing to do it. And the U.S. has said as recently as this week, well, I suppose we can't rule that out. So you might have a Saudi ground force in Syria. This is what the Saudis are saying. They've already intervened in Yemen with airstrikes. And you also have Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, have offered to put ground troops in Syria. Now, this could be the beginning of what this Sunni Arab force we always talk about would have to be, because it doesn't look like it can be Syrians, because the Syrian non-ISIS resistance is on the verge of getting completely wiped out. It doesn't look like that's possible. But now we have to start looking at the pieces on this chessboard individually. And when you take stock of this, this becomes a much more dangerous situation. The ability, or rather the probability of escalation here, of there being some sort of provocation that brings these powers to a head with each other, gets higher with all the forces that are deployed here, all these different countries putting their troops in harm's way. We already had one incident where Turkey shot down a Russian plane. We could have more. That didn't lead to broader military escalation, but you never know what will happen. What happens if all of a sudden this conflict turns into the Assad regime with Russian air cover and Iranian, either IRGC troops or perhaps Hezbollah militia coming into direct conflict with Saudi ground forces? Now you actually have not just a proxy Sunni-Shia civil war playing out, but an actual Sunni-Shia civil war, regional one, with the biggest powers in the region putting their troops up against each other. And keep in mind, the U.S. and NATO are at least allegedly backing these rebels on the ground in Syria. So we also have a hand in this fight, not a very big one, but we are tied to this. We have obligations that we have promised to fulfill. We're asking our regional allies to do more in the fight. So how long do you think it would be before the U.S. has more of an investment in all of this? So the Saudis say they're going to deploy troops. Other Gulf states say they're willing to put remember, this is ground troops, not airstrikes. Put them in Syria to effectively be invading a foreign country. And the Turks watch all of this with a wary and increasingly concerned eye. The Turks have taken in 2.2 million refugees. Turkey says that it is more or less at its breaking point. Some are saying the Turks are going to just turn loose all the refugees they can and point them towards Europe and say, go. This also has the added benefit, by the way, of destabilizing a Europe that Vladimir Putin increasingly wants to see separated, in turmoil, politically fractured. It makes all sorts of sense from his perspective. So by helping to create, and again, this is thinking a few steps ahead on this board, not a lot of this you'll see from our administration, but other administrations, other regimes are thinking in these terms. Putin's actions in Syria have the domino effect of increasing the refugee pressure because, again, in Aleppo, you have people that are fleeing for their lives. They think that if they can't get out, they're going to be exterminated. And so Putin, by adding pressure with airstrikes and whatever else he's doing inside of Syria, is exacerbating the refugee crisis. The refugees in Turkey are therefore more likely, or there's more refugees there in Turkey, is more likely to open up the floodgates. The Turks are sick of this. They have the deputy Turkish prime minister, Akdoğan, saying, on the one hand, they say, open your borders, take everyone in. On the other hand, they say, close your border, don't let anyone through. So the Turks' complaint at this point is that they've been told to lock the border down, except they're supposed to take refugees. What's the difference between a refugee and an ISIS fighter who doesn't happen to have an AK-47 in his hands at the time? Who knows? Your guess is as good as mine. And that also, by the way, increases the destabilizing effect of these refugees, not just the cost, not just the fact that Turkey says they're spending billions of dollars to feed and clothe and house these refugees in camps and the cost to their security forces, but also what happens when they get into Europe. Putin watches all of this, and he recognizes that geographically, Russia doesn't have a refugee problem. It's not Russia's issue. It's Europe's issue. Russia's not about to take in all these people. Europe is going to take in these people, going to continue to after taking in almost a million last year alone. There are many more in the pipeline. Of those 2.2 million refugees in Turkey, how many have already made their way to Europe and how many would like to get to Europe? The Turks know that they hold this as real leverage over the EU and over NATO countries, fellow NATO countries. And this fight is playing out with the U.S. increasingly looking like it's just a bystander to all of this. Russia has been making real moves and taking action that is changing realities on the battlefield. And the U.S. is saying that we back these anti-Assad forces. The U.S. is saying that we have a stake in this and there's a strategy. The Obama administration and Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, they make all these claims. But what you have here is the possibility of a real defeat for any anti-Assad forces that are left. And the continuation, the escalation, really, of a humanitarian crisis. If Aleppo is cut off, what's the difference between Aleppo being cut off from outside supply and Aleppo being starved out? Depends on who's doing the reporting, I suppose. And also the increased intervention of foreign powers who might have their own soldiers, their own troops facing off against each other. And think about the possibility of contagion there. You think the Saudis will let the Iranians get away with killing Saudi troops in Syria without some sort of retribution? I think the UAE and the Qataris and others, if they put troops in harm's way, as they say they want to do now, because if they don't do something here, they know they lose influence and they lose face. They have no proxy in Syria to fight against this Shia axis backed by Russia as well, except for the Islamic State. Are they going to make that choice? Obviously not, at least not openly. They won't claim to do that. Perhaps they'll start doing that more and more behind the scenes, although who knows how much of that's already going on. Syria is a mess. It is a disaster. It is getting worse. Our enemies are getting stronger there, and the Obama administration is holding meetings. You ever thought about generating your own off-the-grid supply of electricity? If so, let me tell you, this is one of the most important messages you will ever hear. President Obama has an anti-coal, anti-electricity policy in place that is pushing electrical rates to all-time highs. But even beyond that, there are real threats to America's very vulnerable power grid. That means there's never been a better time than now to protect your family with a solar generator backup system in the event of an emergency. This new off-the-grid backup technology provides life-saving electrical power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. It's like having an electric power plant running silently in your own home. You run sump pumps, shortwave radios, computers. You can even keep the food in your fridge from spoiling. Whether it's dangerous weather, brownouts, or blackouts, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. So go to BuckSolarBackup.com. You can learn more there. That's BuckSolarBackup.com. If you use coupon code Buck, you get a solar generator for half off. Go to BuckSolarBackup.com today. Back after this break.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
To give you a sense of how discombobulated, how confused it seems policy is for what's going on right now in this part of the world, NATO is deploying ships to the Aegean Sea, deploying warships, to monitor human smuggling networks and deter human smuggling networks, but they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop people from crossing. So they're not like a border. They're not acting as a Coast Guard of sorts. They're not actually going to be in place to prevent more migrants from coming. They're there to monitor the situation and to stop human smuggling. So does that mean that if they see a ship laden with people trying to cross from Turkey to one of the Greek islands where so many of these migrants are making this crossing, that it's going to stop them and do what exactly? Say, hey, who's the smuggler on this ship? Who's in charge here? Arrest that person, and then what happens with the rest of the ship? I assume they board and are let out at the nearest Greek port. They're not stopping it. They say they're not going to prevent them. They're not going to prevent them from making the crossing. So you have NATO's Standing Maritime Group 2, which is under German command and has five ships, will lead the operation. So they're just going to be there in a sort of monitoring and assisting capacity, but they're not, quote, stopping back or pushing back refugee boats. That's from a NATO chief. So they're not stopping the refugee flow. They're just there to stop the human smuggling, which is what's pushing through the refugee flow. It doesn't make any sense, really. And it also would seem to indicate that any vessel that's in duress, well, of course, they're going to go over and pick them up, and then what do they do with them? Where do they drop them off? In Greece, in Turkey? We haven't really thought this through. Because NATO's not really clear on what it wants to do here. Rather, the European countries in NATO aren't clear on what they want to do. All they know at this point is they've got a big problem on their hands. So while all that's playing out, by the way, I'm sure some of you also have seen the latest from Iran, the country that the Obama administration has done everything in its power to placate, to make nicer, make it more our friend. You have Iranian state TV showing video of one of the 10 captured U.S. Navy sailors in tears while they were being held by the IRGC last month. So they're showing one of our sailors crying. This is now being used as propaganda. This is all, by the way, and anything that humiliates prisoners is all a violation of the Geneva Convention. But, you know, Iran doesn't care about these sorts of things. And also, you're seeing on some social media sites that the sailor's capture was being reenacted as part of celebrations marking the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. That's courtesy of FoxNews.com. So there are reenactments now in the street of what are supposed to be the U.S. sailors being captured by the IRGC. So they're using this for straight up propaganda. You know, we were told by the Obama administration that this was the result. Just remember this. This was the result. The release, the speedy release shows us that there's an improvement in relations, and this is the result of smart diplomacy. Meanwhile, they are mocking us. They're violating Geneva Convention. They are spitting in our face as a country. The administration has nothing, will do nothing about it. Absolutely nothing. And you can say, oh, well, that's just all bellicose rhetoric. What are you going to do, invade Iran over this? Well, you're not going to invade, but doing nothing seems to be not the right answer either. And other countries and other enemies across the Middle East see this sort of humiliation of the United States as an invitation for their own future humiliations of the United States and our soldiers, our airmen, our Navy, anyone they can get their hands on, U.S. citizens too. So another version of the Obama administration's policy on display.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
When our water heater broke down last month, it was a nightmare. It took 5 hours for the plumber to show up, and he charged us a couple of $100 just to come out. Then it cost another $1,800 to put in the new water heater. By the time it was all said and done, I felt like I'd been taken. But what else could I do?
The smartest thing you can do is get a home warranty from American Residential Warranty. Their home warranties pay to repair or replace all your major appliances when they break. And they will break, and at the worst possible time. Call American Residential Warranty right now for free information on home warranties starting at just pennies a day. Don't wait for your refrigerator to stop running or your ceiling fans to stop turning. Call American Residential Warranty right now. Ask how you can save up to 50% on washer and dryer coverage. Just call 1-800-686-3910. That's 1-800-686-3910. Again, 1-800-686-3910. Call now.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show. Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
All right, team, we can take some calls. 888-900-3393. We have Mary in Indiana. Mary, welcome to The Buck Sexton Show.
Thank you, Buck. I've called once before, but I want to tell you how much I appreciate you and service that you did for our country. And you're one of my favorite hosts on this. But I called to tell you that a nephew had filled out his income tax check, and he didn't have insurance, so they kept every bit of it. He didn't get
so
any of it.
The penalty, yeah?
Yeah, is that from Obama?
Mm-hmm, from Obamacare. There's a penalty now in place.
Yeah, so I was just letting everybody know if they don't have insurance, don't expect their returns.
Well, the return's definitely going to be smaller because they take it right out of there.
I
hear you. Thank you very much for calling in. I appreciate hearing from you. I appreciate your kind words. Thanks for calling into the Buck Sexton Show, Mary. So there's a very interesting back and forth recently from a couple of conservatives that are dealing with, give their view of what they think the Trump appeal is. And it's not just about Trump. It raises much broader issues of the working class in this country and what is really offered to them by conservatism. Kevin Williamson, who we've had here on the show many times, wrote a piece in National Review that was very critical of the Trump supporters. As Kevin wrote a book on why Trump is a buffoon and a charlatan. He couldn't be any more clear or more outspoken on the issue, and essentially saying that they're being swindled, that they're being bamboozled, they're being tricked by a very talented fraudster in the form of Donald Trump. Michael Brendan Doherty, also a writer, writes on politics, culture, other issues. He takes issue with this and he says, well, let's take a step back and start to ask the question, what exactly does the modern conservative movement in this country offer people? What does it offer people who aren't necessarily in a position to compete, who are struggling, who are the working class? You can understand at a very basic level the appeal of somebody, being told that they have free college and free health care now. It can be a little more difficult to say, well, we offer you pathways to entrepreneurship and what's more appealing politically, somebody who's promising you free stuff or freedom is the very basic way to put it down. We're now joined by Tom Nichols. He's a professor at the U.S. Naval War College. He's also a senior contributor at The Federalist. Tom, thank you for calling in.
Glad to be with you, Buck.
So I see you wrote a piece that sort of looks at both the Williamson pieces and the MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty piece, on whether the white working class that supports Trump, whether they're being swindled by him or whether conservatism actually has anything to offer them. I kind of want to let you just work through your thesis on this a little bit. You say that the working class is not a lost cause for conservatism. Why?
Well, you know, it was interesting because, as we call him, MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty, he talked about how this affected people in white male working class enclaves like, and then he mentioned two cities, Garbutt, New York, and Chicopee, Massachusetts. Well, that got my attention because I'm actually from Chicopee, Massachusetts, and I actually grew up there, and I thought he was being unfair. He basically was saying that Trump is filling a void, that the Republicans are keeping things too abstract. They're talking about, you know, interest rates and tax relief and things that only matter to rich guys, and that conservatives needed to target these white working class males with a message that resonates more for them. And his example, and he admits that it was a caricature for effect, but his example was a guy hooked on Oxy or Vicodin who was jobless and trying to keep his life together. And, you know, how do we speak to them? And how does Trump speak to them? My answer to that was that I thought that, and Kevin Williamson basically echoed what I said. He responded to Doherty as well to say, that's really condescending. That's really a kind of giving up on working class white males and assuming that the only way that you can get through to them is to do what liberals do. To treat them like victims, to condescend to them, to promise them more stuff. And I just found that really off-putting. And I suppose, again, it twigged in my head because one of the places he mentioned is actually a place I grew up where I still have friends and I still have family living there. And I just didn't recognize the cartoon that Doherty drew of these working class white men. I think they can be a lot better than that. And I think they're being seduced by Trump's message, which I would add, that is becoming indistinguishable from Democrats.
Well, because I wanted to get beyond whether it's cartoonish, because he also had a cartoonish, what was it, hedge fund manager or some finance guy who's doing cocaine in Darien.
And
I'm not sure how many hedge funds are in Darien, but nonetheless, he was, you know, he did caricatures on both sides, I think, to make the point. But the issue he was trying to also get to was one of messaging, right? And why does the Trump, and I know you're about to go there, but I just wanted to push it in a specific direction, and that is, why is the Trump message resonating with working class white voters in this way? And what is a better message from conservatism that can compete with the Bernie Sanders or just the straight up Democrat version of things, which is we'll give you more stuff. We'll give you Obamacare. We'll give you, in the case of Bernie Sanders, free health care. We'll give you free college or greatly reduced rates on college supported by the taxpayer. The counter messaging from conservatives to non-college educated working class white males, some of whom support Trump, should be what?
That we'll create an environment where you can get a job. That conservatives will get the government off your back. It will get tax rates down so that other people can employ you. It will clean up the streets and make your neighborhood less unsafe so that you can actually live somewhere without fear of your life. What it can't do, and this is my problem with both Doherty and Trump's appeal, you can't get into an arms race with the liberals about promising stuff because conservatives will always lose. Our heart is not in that. We can't promise to make college more free than Bernie Sanders. That's a dead end. Conservatives were never about that. And my fear is that, I think, just let me be clear, that I think Doherty had good intentions, but I think he ended up basically saying, look, the only way conservatives can really compete is to see if they can out-pander liberals on things that no one can deliver. Bernie Sanders is never going to make college free. That's never going to happen. We're never going to have a $20 minimum wage. We're never going to do any of that stuff. And I think to get into that sort of, if you want the white working class, then you've just got to out-promise them things I think is crazy, because in the end, a working class voter will vote for a real Democrat over a fake Democrat every time.
Right, but let's not use for our purposes for now Bernie Sanders as the guy on the other side of the table. I know that's relevant and that's fair because he is one of the guys on the other side of the table right now. But I think the assumption that I still make, and Tom, I could be wrong these days, I don't know. But the assumption is still that it will be Hillary, that it will be a more mainstream Democrat, and that white working class voters in places like Ohio and other states that are essential battleground states will be essential to whichever side of this is going to win when it comes to a general election. Is conservatism creating the grounds for people to succeed? That may be ideologically pure, but if you're just looking at this from the perspective of what works, can you convince people to pull the lever based on we'll clear the playing field and then whatever happens, happens?
Well, I think part of it is that Republicans are have been scalded by the effect of the financial crash in 2008. So they don't want to make arguments like I think John Kasich is making, for example, where you can say, if you give us time, and I'm not a Kasich guy, but he makes a good argument to say, look what I did in Ohio. I can actually do that. There are examples of Republican success, especially in the governor's offices and around the country. So you can actually make that case. But the other case I think that Republicans are afraid to make is to say, if you think your life is bad right now, think about who's been in power for the last 8 years. Think about the policies that have led to the collapse of the family over the past 40 years. We're the people, we conservatives, I don't just mean Republicans, because I'm not a Republican. We conservatives are the people that have been fighting against that kind of social collapse and hollowing out of the small towns for all that time. And the problem is, of course, that a lot of candidates say, well, that's just being negative. Well, Hillary Clinton's going to take credit for every good thing that's ever happened since 1960. I mean, you can just see that coming already, especially in that ghastly appeal to young women, you know, that if it weren't for me, Hillary Clinton, you'd all still be in the kitchen and barefoot and all that nonsense. So, I mean, in some sense, yes, there has to be a criticism the past 40 years. But your question's a really good one, which is, what do you replace it with? And I think that conservatives need to really think hard about this and go back to the well about ideas from people like Jack Kemp, and things like, you know, preferential tax rates for businesses to start. Part of the problem, Buck, is that anything that creates jobs also benefits entrepreneurs. And that's what Trump and the Democrats are both going after, saying, look, those guys will get rich too. But as Roger,
I worry, Tom, because I hear a lot of Republican, and I know you're distinguishing yourself between Republicans and conservatives, and I'm speaking about this broadly because I do hear it from a lot of the candidates and in general from the conservative movement and from people inside and outside the GOP. They talk about sort of the entrepreneurial spirit. I make jokes with this. Like, not everybody can be an entrepreneur. And by the way, a large majority of entrepreneurs, a lot of new businesses fail. Depends on what sector we're talking about. But, you know, starting your own business is usually a risky venture, and you have a lot to lose. It's not just like losing your job. You could lose your life savings. So we can't be a nation where everybody gets to be an entrepreneur. We have to be a nation where there also are employees, not just employers. And
but
I think that's where the Republicans and also the conservative movement's appeal starts to feel a little more amorphous. It's, you know, you've got on the one side, and I agree with you that it's an arms race of promises, but okay, well, what do you say to somebody who doesn't have an advanced degree or doesn't even have a college degree, and you're going to say that we support solid, intact family structure? Okay, what else can we say?
Well,
or should be
a couple of things. First of all, I think conservatives ought to be the ones saying, look, and Rubio, I think, delivered this effectively. Not everybody has to go to college. That's one of the most destructive myths of the late 20th and early 21st century. More people have been led to ruin by just this notion that everybody has to go to college. And I think, you know, saying that we need more welders than philosophers is a good line. Beyond that, though, you're right. Everybody can't be an entrepreneur. But, you know, I was thinking back when you were saying this about something Roger Ailes, of all people, said over 20 years ago, which is, you don't ask poor guys for a job. If you're going to have a job, somebody has to create that job. There has to be somebody who's willing to take a risk and put you to work. And what Trump has done, and where he is right in the same lane as the Democrats, and where I think Daugherty was right in the same lane, is he is exploiting class envy and status envy to the point where, unless you basically promise income equalization and to eat the rich, you're not going to get through to those folks. And I don't think that's true. I think you can go back to a 1980s kind of argument I mean, remember when the Republicans first came back in the 1980s, America was flatter on its back than it is now. People don't believe that, but if you lived through the 1970s, it's true. And we actually made a good argument in those days for getting government out of the way, investing, creating opportunity zones, giving people more chance to actually go to work and keep more of their money. But if all we get into is the rich are out to screw you, I'm a billionaire and I'll screw them back, well, then no one can compete with that message, because when you're upset and depressed, that message is really appealing. It's self-destructive, but it's appealing.
All right. Tom Nichols of The Federalist. You can read his latest on TheFederalist.com, and you can check out also some of the pieces he refers to by Kevin Williamson, Michael Brendan Doherty. They're linked in his piece. Go to TheFederalist.com. Tom, thank you for calling in. Great to talk to you.
You too, Buck. Thank you.
All right, team, much more coming after the break. I'll be right back.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show.
All right, team, we've got Josh in Hawaii. He served in the Navy. He's back now. He wants to talk some more. Josh, thanks for calling in. Aloha. What's going on?
Look, how are you doing today?
Good.
So I was calling about the Navy Riverines that basically, you know, gave up to the Iranians. That unit started after USS Cole got bombed, and it was actually called the Mobile Security Squadron. And from there, they reorganized everything for funding purposes and became the NECC, which is the Naval Expeditionary Combat Command. And so that unit falls underneath that. However, those guys go through a lot of training, not just, you know, operating the boats, but navigational. And, you know, Article 2 under the POW, you're never supposed to freely surrender yourself. And that's the whole issue that I have in that you know, situation that they were in, is that they didn't communicate effectively and then surrendered immediately to the Iranians.
You're saying they did do that, or they did not do that?
Well, I'm assuming they did, because there was no shots fired, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding too, yeah.
And they were, you know, they were leaving Iraq, most likely UMCSAR, and then headed back to Bahrain. But, you know, whether they were departing from one location or leaving, but the fact that they surrendered, I mean, you know, you have the POW. Everyone's taught the POW rules that were established, and you have the articles, the five articles. And on Article 2, you're never supposed to surrender yourself freely. And so, to my understanding, they basically freely surrendered themselves.
Hmm. So you think that they should have shot it out with this Iranian patrol boat?
I'm not saying they should have shot it out, because they weren't shot upon. You know, they had a positive ID, obviously, of who the threat was at the time. So you have a positive identification on who your threat is, and then you report that. Obviously, the LT that was in charge, you know, he makes the ultimate decision, because he's the ground forcer, the boat operating commander.
The Iranians had guns trained on them, and my understanding, I wasn't there, I've just read the press accounts, is that if they didn't surrender, they were going to get shot. So,
They had the ability to shoot back as well, is what I'm saying.
All right. Well, Josh from Hawaii, again, thanks for your service, and thank you for calling in. Team, we've got a lot more coming up in the next hour. Stay with me. We'll be back right after this break.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining. We have our friend Tom Rogan from National Review, and also a senior contributor to At Op Lives. He's a senior fellow at the Steamboat Institute. Tom, thank you for calling in. Good to talk to you.
Good to be with you, Buck. Thank you for having me on.
So I'm excited for the prospect of somebody with a British accent tearing apart the case for Hillary Clinton as president. You have in your piece here that you think that young people, specifically young people, should not vote for Hillary Clinton. Your piece is titled, Dear Young Americans, Don't Vote for Hillary. Tell me why, Tom. Why should young Americans not vote for Hillary?
Yeah, well, first, a caveat to always put out, because I know there's nothing that Americans hate more than a Piers Morgan-type individual talking. I actually have U.S. citizenship, which I think you know, but your listeners might not. Anyway,
I'm just saying I like your cool accent, Tom, but go ahead.
Well, I know without the accent, my media career would be on a nosedive into oblivion. But the main points that I make with my article are that when Hillary Clinton articulates the role of an expanded government role in terms of both regulation and in terms of things like education and healthcare and taxes and benefits, the actual proven reality of what that does, because that has been happening in Europe now for a generation or more, is that it hurts young people the most. It fosters youth unemployment. For example, if you look at union power, the expanded power of unions makes it much harder for young people to enter the job market and to have that first step into social mobility. If you look at entitlement reform, Hillary Clinton now coming out very strongly against even the most basic reforms, raising the eligibility age in a staggered sense of people who are, you know, earlier in their life, and so it's something that could be planned ahead. She doesn't want to touch that. And if those programs are not reformed, the simple reality is that the country will go broke. And, you know, young people not only will not have those benefits, but will have to pay an ever-escalating tax burden to provide them from older citizens. So I think the central premise of my argument is that where Hillary talks about being the candidate who young Americans should be voting for, the reality is that she proposes policies that would take from the young to provide more to older citizens. And I think there's something morally, quite frankly, grotesque about that.
You also point out that her regulatory proposals, as I see here, cause problems. You're right. For example, she would force companies to provide 12 weeks of paid leave a year. Sounds great on paper. Who wouldn't like more paid vacation time? Yet the rule would break many small businesses that would not be able to afford the added costs. Meanwhile, Clinton only offers three lines on how she would cut red tape for businesses. This is no small issue. Regulatory extremism in America is smashing the middle and lower classes. This is another place where, by the way, I think that there's a whole argument to be made for how we need to get rid of the internship culture in this country, but that's perhaps separate from this. But it does make it harder for small business owners. The regulatory burdens of hiring anyone makes it harder for small business owners to open the kind of jobs that either unskilled or lower skilled people that are just getting started in the workplace would like to have. I know you mentioned unions, but the regulatory burden on small businesses and on people who are starting their own companies in particular is incredibly strong. And it hurts not just the young people who might start companies, but the people that might work for starting companies.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, that's the key point that you talk about. Again, those small businesses, if we think about places across the country where people perhaps haven't gone to college and they've, you know, they haven't gone to trade school and they're looking for that first job and tending to be, you know, they're at the lower end of the economic ladder. They're looking at that first job. If you have a system in which the burdens on an employer to have to provide these added benefits as a rule instead of as an incentive for specialized employees, of course it is going to make it much harder for them to employ people and to choose to potentially employ people, because of course businesses have to plan for the longer term, not just the moment. And again, it just comes down to that. You know, one of the other issues I talked about in terms of regulation is Dodd-Frank. And so when we have this sort of democratic consensus now about, you know, okay, great, more regulation, more regulation, more regulation, fine. I think all of us would say some regulatory reform was needed, some more is also needed. But specifically looking at this idea that you can just impose these taxes without repercussions, I mean, look at Dodd-Frank. I'm sure a lot of listeners will have found their charges going up with their various bank accounts and their ability to access loans. And again, that's another issue, of course, for businesses. It's harder to access loans. And we talk about, you know, the final point. Again, Hillary promising to double down on Obamacare, which, of course, has smashed young people. I mean, I think it's hard to find a young person who would say they think they are getting a good deal under Obamacare, but she wants to reinforce that. And then you think about the longer term, the regulatory impacts on that in terms of, you know, that you get to a certain level of employees, you have to provide that health care. So all of these things add up on paper to this sort of easy populist vein that Hillary Clinton likes to throw out, that the rich person behind the tree, never defined, can pay for all of this. But the fiscal reality and the functional reality where these different policies would come into play, the people who would lose out most are the people who are youngest and least skilled and at the lower end of the economic ladder. And I have to say, as a candidate who claims to care a lot about income inequality, I think there really is a fundamental dichotomy between rhetoric and truth here.
Well, also, as a carrier of the message, Tom, I have to say, Hillary Clinton, it's hard to find a more seemingly hypocritical person to be talking about financial reform, to be talking about the role of money in politics. She's obviously trying to sort of hitch a ride to some degree on the Bernie Sanders enthusiasm, right? She knows that the establishment is still behind her, the Democratic establishment, but she would like to get some boost from the base, or at least kind of ride a little bit on the Bernie coattails until he gets too tired and all of a sudden it's clear that Hillary's the only real candidate. But I think it's really hard for Hillary Clinton to make the case that she cares about financial reform and the banks. I think it's really obviously disingenuous, even to a real leftist, even to people that are generally would have a proclivity to believe her and to like her, because it's just so flatly preposterous. This woman's giving speeches to Goldman Sachs left and right, telling them how awesome they are.
Right. Well, exactly. And look, there is that, you know, fundamental absence of trust. And you see that in the various ways, of course, on the Bernie Sanders, the left of the Democratic Party. There's the concern about honest speaking and honest policy on economics. And of course, on, you know, other elements of the country, there's the concern about honesty and trust in terms of, you know, Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. But I think the problem here is that, you know, at that functional level of detail, one of the big things that I think a lot of liberals, especially in the sort of liberal intellectual side and media, like to purvey is that liberalism is the way forward, that Europe is the proven example of a more equitable society in which people at the bottom, especially, and the middle income levels can benefit most. And I have to say, I think those people must have been looking at some very strange notions of European history, because the reality of the European social welfare state from Scandinavia, and people could just go and Google this, you know, go Google Norway social welfare or France social welfare, and look at the economic damage, look at the entrenched levels of youth unemployment, look at the lack of social mobility. All those tangible things are the product of policies that have been pushed over a long time that bear a very striking similarity to Hillary Clinton's idea that the way forward is to restrain the private sector or temper it into an ideological direction and to create the growth of government towards a social interest. It is not honest, and I think it's provably not honest, and that's what I'm trying to put across, that you can articulate the specifics of why this is such a problem.
I get the sense also that there's been this perception, and I think a lot of Democrats are trying to fan this perception, that Bernie is the purist and Hillary is the pragmatist. But actually, Hillary was a very far left senator. When you look at her voting record, she was to the left of Barack Obama when she was in the Senate. If you compare their two records side by side, she wants much of the same stuff that Bernie Sanders wants. She just sort of haggles a little bit more over how quickly we get there and what the price of it would be. I mean, sure, maybe she can't say free college, but she would be in favor of greater taxpayer subsidy for college. And she wants to use Obamacare as a vessel for the expansion of as much free coverage or subsidized coverage as possible. And I think the point that has to be made that we actually can't afford what he wants or what she wants. I think there's this notion that, well, she's the centrist, she's the realist on these issues. And the fact of the matter is, even her promises, if you were to extrapolate them out and look at them on a timeline of costs over the next 10, 15, 20 years, even Hillary land is not a real place we can go.
Yeah, well, exactly. And look, I have to give my editor, Gillan Ferguson, some credit here, because when I did a piece on Bernie Sanders, the same idea, why young people shouldn't vote for him. And then Gillan said to me, well, actually, what about Hillary Clinton? Exactly what you're saying. And I think there is that fundamental problem. But I think one of the things that conservatives need to be much more active in doing is being able to articulate, okay, why is this idea that the government is going to take much greater role in terms of paying, for example, for education? Why is that bad? Well, it's bad for a simple reason, because the person who didn't go to college and is working hard, either in their own business or working for an employer, people who are trade-skilled professionals, they are going to have to subsidize those things. Money does not come out of just out of the ether. And the final point, I think, is that liberals like to talk about these days the idea that taxes, you know, you can impose higher taxes and you can have sustained economic growth, and they'll go back to studies, you know, certain pickpocketed ideas from, you know, areas of the 20th century. But the reality of today in the 21st century, where capital is so easily movable and people can move their wealth and move their profession, their skills to a locale where, you know, the taxes are lower, the proof is that higher taxes don't work. And the proof of that, again, Europe, the United Kingdom, they tried to raise the tax rate up to 50% during the recession. And it had a really very, very low increase in tax revenue. I'm talking in sort of a few hundred million. And the actual assessment by the Treasury in the UK was that, look, this is actually deterring far more than it's bringing in. The same issue in France, that you see this economic decline. And so this idea, number one, that the rich can pay for everything, fiscally it doesn't add up by the basic sums, even if you're saying you're taxing them at 90%. But in the longer term, it will drive people away. And again, you look at
France drove Depardieu away, a national treasure.
Right. And again, I think you can also articulate this in terms of the United States. You look at the exodus of wealth and capital out of California, for example, into Texas. And I think over the coming years, we'll really be this will be much clearer in terms of the statistics. But it requires that articulation. And most of all, it does require from conservatives that specific rebuttal of the Democratic line, the liberal line, that these policies would help those at the bottom of the economic ladder. Because I do think when it comes to it, in the proven facts and the policy realities, those are the people who lose out most. The wealthy can really insulate themselves from these changes, but those at the bottom of the economic ladder, they are the ones who are most hurt by this. And there's a really, I think, deep pernicious element to the sort of policy delusion that underpins all of this.
All right, well, you can see Tom's latest at National Review. Also, you're a panelist for the McLaughlin Group, correct?
I am, yeah. I'm about the youngest by about 45, but it's great to be on there with journalists who've been doing this a lot longer than I have. And, I get to joke around with McLaughlin, which is always fun.
That's cool. All right. Rock and roll. Yeah. Tom Rogan of NRO and elsewhere. Thank you very much for joining, buddy. Good to talk to you. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Buck. Appreciate it.
Phone lines are open here in the Freedom Hut, 888-900-3393. There's a Democrat debate tonight. We'll talk about that for a little bit. And then some other stuff, more coming up. But first, have you ever thought about a silencer for your firearm? If you haven't, I'm telling you, you probably should. You should go to silencershop.com if you're considering getting a silencer. And I think it's worth considering because it allows you little or no hearing protection while enjoying greater shooting accuracy. It's really great for hunters. It helps you during outdoor sports. If you're shooting at the range, anywhere, silencers are a cool thing to add into your general firearms toolkit. So simply go to silencershop.com. You follow the step-by-step instructions. You watch videos and reviews, and then make the perfect selection from the most popular brands. They handle all the details for you, and your nearest Powered by Silencer Shop dealer will call you when your silencer is ready. SilencerShop.com also offers easy financing. In fact, they return your finance charge as a gift certificate after your final payment. So help make the world a quieter place. Visit SilencerShop.com and find a silencer for your firearm. Back after this break.
This is the Buck Sexton Show
on the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
888-900-3393. That is the phone number here. Also, if you want to send us some thoughts, teambuck@theblaze.com. That is the best way to, by email, get in touch with me and us here in the Freedom Hut. That would be great. So please do give a call. I wanted to get a little bit into my expectations briefly for the Democrat debate tonight, but not yet, because there's something else that I hadn't yet gotten to, and I wanted to, and that is this notion that came up in the last GOP debate. I didn't talk about it. I just got caught up with other things. But whether women should be subject to the draft, and there's a Republican senator who, as of yesterday, Senator Mike Lee, plans to introduce a bill blocking women from registering for the Selective Service after the chiefs of the Army and Marine Corps indicated that they would support requiring women to enter the draft now that the Obama administration has opened up all combat roles to female service members, according to National Review, and this is from the Free Beacon. I'm with Ted Cruz on this. I know there are a bunch of GOP candidates that said that they believe that women should register for the draft. I know there are a lot of people who either are serving or have served who listen to the show, who are members of Team Buck, who joined us here in the Freedom Hut. I'd be curious to know what any female service members think about this, those who obviously volunteered to serve. Do they think that this should do they agree with Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, or do they agree with some of the, I'm forgetting who the Republicans were who said that they thought they should. I think it was a bunch of them. There was a few of them said that women should register for the draft. My sense of this is no. I agree with Ted Cruz on this one. And this sort of, I know that it can be kind of tempting sometimes because the left is always pushing this notion of radical equality, of sort of extreme equality, equality that doesn't take into account legitimate differences and honest and real differences between people, between different groups. I mean, in the case of men and women, you're talking about combat effectiveness and unit cohesion, and how that can play out on the battlefield where, war is hell, as many of you know yourself or know from family members or friends who have served. And Ted Cruz's point, which, by the way, I also saw was misconstrued by the media as to say that, like, there are maniacs in the foxholes. He meant that an opposing army that has men that are fighting against women, if it gets into hand-to-hand combat, women are at an inherent, almost always, I know there are people who say, well, what about, and they'll name like some female MMA fighter, but generally speaking, women are at a tremendous physical disadvantage in hand-to-hand combat. I don't really understand why this is controversial, but I also am surprised to see the GOP sort of going along with this. Now that the military has opened these combat roles, everyone seems to have agreed right now. There's sort of this consensus opinion that's formed that as long as there's no lowering of the standards for women in units as elite as the Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, you name it, that's fine. Well, what you're going to find out is that soon there'll be charges of discrimination brought, or there'll be people who are filing lawsuits saying, well, this unit doesn't have enough women in it, so clearly there must be some anti-female bias. And at some point you're going to want to say, well, is the anti-female bias the genetic difference between XX chromosome and XY chromosome? And we're not allowed to really talk about this anymore, which is just becoming increasingly bizarre and increasingly strange. I remember actually one of the more contentious things I think I posted on Facebook in terms of people who usually agree with me, or oftentimes I think agree with me on a whole host of things, is when I said that I think that there's something different between women in mixed martial arts and men. And they got all mad at me, and people were saying, oh, well, that's just because girls could kick guys' butts and guys don't. It has nothing to do with that at all. It just has to do with the differences in, well, one, as a society, between how we view men and how we view women and violence against them. But also, if women heading soccer balls, as now the science is showing, is more dangerous because of the difference in bone density and sternocleidomastoid and the muscles around the neck and how it can take the torsion of hitting a ball over and over and over again. If that's different for high school age girls and high school age guys, and the science is showing that it is, I would think that getting punched in the face is also quite different, but I digress. But people really disagreed with me on that. And so I think it's, and conservatives, some of them, it seemed, disagreed with me on that. So I'm very curious. I don't have a whole lot more to say on this other than my gut reaction is women should not register for the draft, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Call in and let me know. 888-900-3393. Would love to hear some opinions on this one. I know I have sort of a traditional sensibility about some of these things, and that can get me into hot water with some, but that will spice things up. Let's talk a bit about the Democrat debate and some other fun stuff.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show.
Well, I really wanted to get some sense from you, from Team Buck, as to what you think about whether women should be exempted from the draft or not. But I actually see here we had a Blaze poll done on February 3rd from the Godfather, Mike Opelka, whom we got to have the Godfather. We got to put out the bat signal for the Godfather to come on the show maybe tomorrow or there. Ooh, hey, little tunage there. I like that. We got to have the Godfather show up, so I'll put out the Godfather bat signal which will require all of a text message from me, I think. We'll get in touch with our man, Mike. But he did a Blaze poll. And for those of you who are curious, I'm very curious. This was with 4,600 votes. And look, I know it's an unscientific. This is just like click poll, but whatever. Should the U.S. government require women to register for the draft when they turn 18, just as they require men to do? 64% of those who partook in this poll said yes. 33% said no. So on this issue, I'm in the minority. I'm at least when it comes to this portion of Blaze readers, Blaze.com readers. So again, maybe, you know, this is sort of like the women in MMA thing, which I also just I still stick to my guns on that, or my fists, so to speak, or, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? I stick to my side on that issue. And that is that I don't think that I think MMA is for guys. I think women punching each other in the face for sport entertainment says something bad about a society. That's me. Yeah. And I got people wrote me all kinds of nasty things, you know, and, you know, so-and-so fighter woman is going to beat you up, whatever. I said, okay, sure. But anyway, I guess I could be wrong on this. So if you have any opinions on this, I'm very curious to know. Tonight, there is a Democrat debate. You'll notice that we've sort of veered away today on the show, and I'm doing this intentionally. First of all, we started off with a buck brief on national security because incredibly important stuff is happening in Syria right now. You have the death count, by the way, that was released today. I forget what the source was, but it's now the number everyone's using. Is I think it's 460 or 470,000 dead in Syria. I mean, I remember the Syrian civil war has largely coincided with my time here at the Blaze, and I remember covering this originally back in the real news days when this still seemed like it might be a shorter duration conflict. I remember the number got to 100,000 and people just thought that was horrific beyond imagination. Now we're at almost 500,000 dead, a few million wounded, and millions more displaced. This is a disaster that is not contained. It's not just a problem for other countries. It's increasingly going to become a problem for us in one way or another. It's just a matter of time. But anyway, that's all happening, and the media is still focused on, you know, what the latest Trump tweet is. So I've really made a conscious effort, as you can tell, to try to get us into some other stuff. It's problematic because I do the analysis and, you know, I do the analysis end of the equation, and I'm not out there. You know, I don't live in Abu Dhabi, right? I'm not telling you what's going on in some foreign country right now because I'm down there covering parliament or whatever, covering the royal family. I have to rely to some extent on the news wires to come in to get a picture of what's going on around the world. And then we all sit here and we talk about it. And that's how we roll in the Freedom Hut. So when the media is 90% focused on the horse race of politics, it's tough sometimes. This is just because I see the notes that you write me and some of the concerns. You're like, look, let's not do too much in politics. I totally agree with you. I think some of the horse race stuff, you're beating a dead horse. Pardon the bad wordplay. But there's only so much one can do in a day-to-day news cycle that's not politics when the entirety of the media apparatus wants to act like every day, you know, every new poll is like a glimpse at the Super Bowl or something amazing. It's just not the case, but this is the way the media likes to cover it. And also it gives an excuse, you know, ratings go up in an election year, and you know, there are a lot of people who quite honestly don't have much to say, but it's not hard to sort of know the sorts of things you can say about a political race, right? Now I'm giving you sort of a little peek behind the punditry sphere here, but there are people that go on TV that have expertise, you know, that could sit down in a room full of actual experts and hold their own on any number of topics, right? There are people who could sit down and really have an in-depth discussion on something and show that they have a level of knowledge that's beyond just what they get from reading a newspaper. And then there are people that are just faking it. And there are more people who just fake it on politics than anything else. I can tell you that much right now. More people who are just like, oh, well, you know, there's going to be some winners and there's going to be some losers. You know, the polls will go up. But also, let me tell you something, Bob. The polls could go down as well. And, you know, we'll have to see whether that ad campaign works. Or there's also the possibility that the opponent will actually gain some steam here. You know, who has the better ground game? I mean, all this stuff, right? There's people go on TV and it's just sort of repeating a lot of the conventional wisdom. I mean, I find the sort of competing political philosophies of the different candidates interesting, and that aspect of it. And I'm much less interested, generally speaking, in the sort of the personalities and the disputes therein. And you know, the sort of more sport aspect of it. I like more the philosophical aspect of the race, but that's not where often the focus goes. So with all that said, I mean, tonight you have a Democratic debate with Bernie and Hillary, and I'm going to be covering it, meaning that I'm going to be – or live tweeting it, rather, covering it, sorry. Well, I'll be live tweeting it to the degree that there's things to live tweet about. I can't imagine it's going to be very different from the last debate. You only have two people. You know, I have to say, as much as we were criticizing Hillary and the Democrats for their unwillingness to have a lot of debates, now I think it's kind of a mercy that there's only two of them left. We've already heard everything Bernie Sanders really has to say. We've really already heard everything Hillary has to say at this stage. She will change pretty clearly once she becomes a nominee, and she'll try to run back towards the center. And this is an old conventional political wisdom, right? That you, in the primary, you go to the polls of ideology, so to speak. And then when it comes time to actually win the general election, you run back towards the center. We all get that. We know that. Fine, right? That's established. That's like saying, well, you know, a lot of candidates, but only one of them can win. Yes, also true, political analyst man. But it's sort of like, what's the John? Who's the guy that Frank Caliendo, and he does the John Madden, right? You know, at the end of the game, you know, that whole thing. It's like that. Whoever has more points, I can't do John Madden, but you know what I'm saying. So Hillary tonight with Bernie Sanders, the one thing she's going to try to do, because I think it's the only place where Bernie's has created a beachhead against her campaign that will be there when the Republicans are trying to use it. Or there already are, but whoever the Republican is that's facing off against her is going to have the opportunity to sort of piggyback off of these attacks, and that is that Hillary is sort of bought and paid for by – literally bought and paid for. Not metaphorically, right? We're not talking about like, oh, well, she's buddies with them. No, we're talking about checks written cash in hand in large amounts from Wall Street. That Hillary's bought and paid for by Wall Street is something that I think is going to be very tough for her to shake off. The media is trying. I've sat in the room with people who in the media have tried. Oh, well, you know, that's what the market will bear. Really? That's what the market will bear? Over $100 million for them to give some speeches? That's what the market will bear? You're going to tell me there's no influence being brought to bear there at all on the decision-making processes that maybe Hillary Clinton is going to be the most powerful person in the world in the near future? You know, we're supposed to believe that had nothing to do with this at all? As I've said, all you have to do to clarify this issue is to just set up a scenario where you have, let's say to pick somebody, this will be kind of fun. John Kasich becomes the next president of the United States, okay? And John Kasich's wife becomes a very, don't make fun of people's wives here. I'm just trying to give you an analogy. John Kasich's wife becomes a very prominent first lady, and she is making it known that she wants to run for higher office herself. And she also is a really fantastic finger painter. You know, she does these amazing finger paintings. And all of a sudden, you've got all these U.S. corporations that are paying her like $500,000 for her finger painting because, you know, they say it's so great. Now, she's never sold the painting before, and no one's ever been paid this much for finger painting in particular, because usually that's what preschoolers do. But, you know, she has these finger paintings and they're paying her $500,000 a painting. And people say, oh, well, you know, that's what the market will bear. And then she runs for Senate somewhere and she wins that Senate seat. And then John Kasich is out of office and now he's doing finger painting. You know, he's a painter of sorts. He's into portraiture. He does portraits. You know, he's more old school that way. I like his finger painting is like caveman style, but still he's doing old school stuff. Portraiture. And his portraits are getting $500,000 all of a sudden out of nowhere. Right. It's like, whoa, wow. And people just can't get enough of John Kasich's paintings. And his wife wants to run for – his wife, let's say, becomes, to make it easy, Secretary of State in an administration. She doesn't win the presidency, but she becomes Secretary of State. But all the while she's Secretary of State, she keeps selling these paintings all over the world, and people are paying her $1 million a painting. And the only thing they can offer up is, oh, no, that's what the market will bear. You know, when there's some big trade agreement that we're trying to work out with, you know, Dubai or something, right? Or they want control of U.S. ports for security purposes or whatever it may be, but they're buying $1 million paintings from her. Well, that's what the market will bear. Do you think anybody would say that was okay? Would anybody go, oh, well, you know, come on. I mean, you know, people wanted to pay it. I mean, I've just come up with a brilliant idea. If you are in office under the Clinton rule, have your spouse set up, you know, become a motivational speaker and just say that you'll take money from anybody. Or she'll take money from anybody. And then let's just see what the market will bear, man. You know, even better, have her set up a foundation. Or if it's her husband, have the husband set up a foundation. Take donations from anybody. You know, you're the governor of a state. Hey, anybody in the state that has business interest, I mean, anybody who really wants a motivational speech, write me a check. Nobody would accept that. It's just so obvious, right? It's so blatant. But because we don't have Hillary Clinton on tape saying, hey, Goldman Sachs, I've got your back when I become the president. Or, hey, I'm the Secretary of State. I've got your back, Russian uranium mining interest. Thanks for this big sack of cash. We're supposed to think that this isn't corrupt. This is what she can't outrun. This is the part of her campaign that's not going away. And the most dogged, and there are people that really, there are people, and I come across them, and some of them go on TV in various places, and I've spoken to them. There are people who will debase themselves for the Clintons. I mean, they will put on a horsehair shirt and walk across the room on their knees, hands outstretched, singing praises of the Clintons. They don't care. It doesn't matter because they know that that's where their bread is buttered, hopefully gluten-free. That's where they get, that's where they're going to get their job. That's where they're going to get their access. And it doesn't matter that they are making a mockery of their own integrity in the process. For them, it's a value proposition that couldn't be more clear, which is get the Clintons back into office. Have their back. Support them. Do whatever you have to do. It's interesting. You can have, and I've had this experience already, you can have an honest conversation with a Bernie Sanders supporter. You can talk to a Bernie Sanders supporter about what's good about Sanders, what's not. That doesn't mean they're going to agree with you by any stretch. They don't like things like numbers and math because you say, how will this be paid for? What about the debt? What about, you know, no. But at least you have some sense that they're not actively trying to dissemble. They're not actively trying to thwart the truth in the conversation or the search for the truth in the conversation by just being willing to say and do anything. Right? That's one of the amazing effects of the Clintons. It's not just that they themselves are so corrupt. It's that their apparatus is just a giant exercise in the osmosis of corruption as well. It's just sort of just slowly seeping out into all these people around them. And that's what I think Hillary can't outrun, and that's what I think might come out in the debate tonight to some degree once again. I'm hoping Bernie Sanders takes her to task. Hey, you know, you say you got to do this, but really, you know, you got your hands stretched out, and you're taking all this cash, and it's ridiculous, and you know what? That's enough. It's hypocritical. The millionaires and billionaire class, you know all the rest. Break here, back in a minute.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton,
the Blaze Radio Network.
All right, we got Jason from D.C. Jason, only about 90 seconds. I have a feeling you're going to need it all, so go.
Hey, you know, a number of years ago, Hillary Clinton was giving a speech in Las Vegas, and everybody made a big hubbubaloo about the fact that somebody threw a shoe at her. Now, what everybody forgot to mention is the fact that she was giving a speech to the International Metal Recycling Association. What possibly could she be telling them? I mean, was her dad a junk man? Does she collect scrap iron on the side? I mean, this is nothing more than basically a modern-day way of putting cash in a brown paper bag. And only a fool would do that nowadays. Like you were saying earlier, going to the painting business, going to the motivational speech business. And this whole idea that I've sacrificed my life for public service. You want to know what? Al Gore's worth more than Mitt Romney. Okay? And Hillary Clinton, I think the latest numbers over the last 10 years, they made, now this is including the Clinton Foundation money, they have made $150 million, $15 million a year. She's not in the one, she's not in the 0.1, she's in the 0.01%.
And now she wants to lecture us all about the middle class and Wall Street.
Well,
that's what
well don't worry. Her daughter's the same, though, because Chelsea Clinton says, money's not important to her, but she lives in a $10 million condo in New York City. Money's not important to her. Just wait. They're going to tee her up as some sort of a savior.
No, it's appalling, dude.
I respect.
Go ahead.
Your point about Bernie Sanders is spot on. Look, he reminds me of Daniel Patrick Moynihan. I might not have agreed with him, but at least I knew where the guy stood. All right, Hillary Clinton, look, just sit there and just keep going. Look, your foreign policy is Libya, okay? George Bush might have had Iraq. You had Libya. That place is a disaster. And you kept pushing, supposedly you pushed for Syria. And how's that working out?
That's like I'm saying, everybody, all first ladies out there, go into the finger painting business. It's very lucrative, I hear. Jason from D.C., good to talk to you, my friends. Third hour coming up, Team Buck. Stay with me.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to Hour 3 today in the Freedom Hut. Thank you very much for joining. Great to have you with me. We are now joined by a special guest. We have Victor Davis Hanson. He's a historian. He's also a National Review Institute fellow. He joins us now. Mr. Hanson, thank you for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
So I see your piece here, In Searches of Fixes for a Fossilized Economy. And you sort of go piece by piece through first these sort of Obama claims about where the economy is and then the realities of it. The president right now, and he's been on sort of a victory tour recently talking about how unemployment's below 5%. The president's making it sound like things are great. But if you listen to the Democrats in the debates, never mind the Republicans, they make it sound like things aren't going so well with the economy. It sounds like they're onto something. What are the problems, the sort of macroeconomic problems with the economy right now that don't get reflected in the official unemployment rate?
Well, there's two problems. One is that the non-participation rate, and that's probably a more accurate observance of who's working and not, is up to 62%, or 90 million people are just not employed that could be employed. And then second, we had less than 1% GDP, and we have 2% population growth. So the economy in real terms is shrinking. And third, household income is going down. So those are things that are far more important to most people. And the question is, what do you do about it? And when that's happened in past recessions or after past recessions, we had an arsenal that people pick. We never quite did everything at once, but we either, lowered interest rates. But we've already lowered interest rates almost to 0% on passbook accounts. And even a CD after 5 years only pays 2%. So we're basically transferring hundreds of billions of dollars from savers to people who enjoy very cheap interest rates on cars, homes, and that hasn't worked. So then we also try to, when energy is high, we try to lower taxes on energy, but energy's low. It's at historic low. We've saved $250 million. We're going to save $250 million this year in gasoline prices alone.
And this is just the good fortune of the Obama administration,
exactly.
Despite his best efforts, right? The realities of the technology have changed the game dramatically.
And it's even worse than that. It came despite, not because of his efforts, because he shut down new oil leases on federal lands. He tried to stop fracking. But that hasn't helped. Another way is increase the money supply. We're up to $12 trillion. That hasn't helped. And deficit spending and increasing the national debt. He's doubled the debt. He will have doubled the debt in 8 years. And we call a $500 billion deficit, which is larger than any we had in the first 7 years of the Bush administration, as success. Because we've raised taxes and we had sequestration. So what I get him at is in every quiver, every arrow in his quiver has been used. You inflate the money, lower interest, run up deficits, get a big national debt, get cheap energy. And if that's not working, and it's not working, then there's something intrinsically wrong with the economy. And I think part of it's global, but part of it is We've added a huge healthcare burden with Obamacare. We've added regulations. We've psychologically jawboned business from, you didn't build that, not time to profit, you've made enough money. We've created a psychological climate in which people who are going to invest or take risks that, you know what, whether it's the politicalization of the IRS or what, I don't trust this administration, I'm just going to wait it out. And so that's been bad. And then it's not good to reward people who take on debt and punish people who try to invest.
Who save, right. There is a transfer of wealth. I mean, I hear from the generation above me that there was a time when you could have a savings account, and that was actually a form of building wealth, because if you had a savings account over time, it grew.
Everybody got 5% on a passbook, and 7 or 8 if you put it on a long-term CD. So what we're basically telling people is, look at it this way. If you had a small farmer business in the 1980s and you sold it for $1 million, or would you rather go work for the DMV? And in California, just to take one example, if you had that $1 million on a passbook account, you might get $10,000 a year in interest. And if you work for the DMV for 25 years, you probably get about $60,000. That $60,000 is basically worth $6 million in the bank. So we've shifted money from people who are entrepreneurial and created capital and used to get a return on their savings to people who work for government, to take one example. It's much better.
What could be done to turn this? I mean, if I could get all of the GOP candidates, and let's just pretend even Trump, and he would promise to be polite and wouldn't interrupt you.
Yeah.
If I could get them all to sit down with you, what would you tell them? What would you tell them needs to be done to turn around, as you call it, this fossilized economy?
I think 3 or 4 things. I would try to get the jawbone the Federal Reserve to get interest rates back up to at least 2 or 3%, 4%. And then, because we'd have a higher debt service cost, we would have to start doing something like Simpson-Bowles and address the long-term debt and get down to a balanced budget within 4 years. And then we'd have to simplify the tax code, because it encourages fraud, it encourages investments that are not helpful for the economy, just for the write-off value of them. So we'd have to simplify and redo the tax code would help. We'd have to prune back a lot of these regulations. We're the largest coal producer. There's a way to produce coal that's clean. We can't even export it under this the government shutting down coal. We could be a big exporter of natural gas and coal all over the world. That would help. We need to, again, we have to go through all of these agencies. Just think for a minute. When I mention the word VA, GSA, IRS, EPA, you think of scandal now. And the government is so large that people have got a view of it that says it's antithetical to what I want to do as an individual business person. So we've got to prune back regulation. Then we need a president who's optimistic and believes in the values of free enterprise, private property, free market capitalism, and says that, rather than going abroad and always contextualizing the United States values or the contextualizing profit at the same time that his own lifestyle is predicated on, you know, hyper-materialism, whether it's Martha's Vineyard or Rancho Mirage or playing golf. It just makes people cynical, and it creates something like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, because people are just angry that this elite that we have talks one way and then lives quite a different way. So I don't think throughout history it's very important, the psychological element, that you have people in control of the government that people respect, and they feel that their deeds match their words, and they don't attack people who are successful and create this envy. We have sort of a climate or a generation of envy, you know, one percenters, they did this to us, they did that. Listening to Hillary Clinton is an attack on herself, basically.
No, we were talking about that actually in the last hour, that there's no better person you could point to, no more obvious person who has been bought and sold by Wall Street and yet stands up and pretends to be so tough on Wall Street. It would be laughable if it weren't so cynical. But also, I wanted to ask you about some of the signs that people are pointing to now that maybe some of this is going to, you know, you talked about structural changes that would put us on the right path. Are you worried that the train is going to start to come off the tracks here? The market's obviously been very volatile. Today there were some big stories about how people are rushing to gold because they're worried about the dollar. Do you think that we're getting to a point now, because we're approaching $20 trillion in debt, we'll be at about $20 trillion by the time Obama leaves office, that some of these structural shortcomings are going to actually become painful? They'll manifest themselves in ways that people are aware of.
I think the media hasn't even caught up with it, because if you were an upper middle class, take one group, and you have a little, say you have $100,000, where are you going to put it? Are you going to go out and put it in the stock market right now and see it go down by 3% next year? Or are you going to go put it in a savings account and get zero interest? Are you going to go try to go and invest in real estate after what happened in 2008? So that creates a sense of despondency. People don't know what to do with it. And then they tend to work longer. So I grew up in a generation where my parents retired in their late 50s and early 60s. I'm 62. I don't know anybody of my age that wants to retire now. They do not want to retire. And what's happening is we're creating this $1.3 trillion aggregate student debt. They go to these universities, and we have a whole generation of kids. Everybody I know's kids are living at home with a bachelor's degree, and they don't have the capital to go out and buy a house. They don't want to get married. They're not having children, at least in the family structure they're not. And part of the reason is we've got sort of a bottleneck where people in my generation say, you know what, there's no way that I could retire. I don't trust Social Security is going to be there enough. It's facing a financial catastrophe. There's no money on passbook. There's nowhere to invest. I'm just going to keep getting my salary. I don't really care whether somebody younger should have my job at the, you know, at the post office or the university or the high school teaching job. Whatever it is, people are sticking in their jobs much longer, and it's an ossifying, slowing down process. And
This has been happening in Europe. I mean, in Europe, it's been sort of the standard for a while that people live at home.
That's what we're doing. That's a good example, because when you go to Europe, and I go there a lot, and I get interviewed, say, by a journalist, I just expect the guy lives at home. And I talk to him. I say, what are you doing? He's always the same story. I'm waiting for a job to open up at the Bureau of Information or the National Tourist Office or whatever, and they won't retire. And then he says, I'm freelancing on the side for cash. I need cash, and I'm living with my parents, and I'm not married, and I'm 40 years old. And somehow Obama looks at that society, and he thinks, you know what, that's egalitarian. It's fair. We're going to model ourselves after that. And so,
right. Bernie Sanders explicitly says that now. I mean, it is like, to borrow from Marco Rubio, he's running for president of Sweden.
Yeah, it is. And so we've got a guy on the left, and I don't know where Trump is on the right, but both of them, they don't articulate why people are really mad, but they are trying to, people see them, and whatever their particular politics are, they read that into that candidate. So some people say, well, all the wealthy have rigged the system, and Trump is saying all the people in government have rigged the system. But they're able to say that because the system's not working for most people, at least as they remember their fathers and mothers said it was working. And we need an entrepreneurial dynamic type of government that says, I'm going to get out of the way. I'm going to turn you guys loose. If you want to build Keystone, we can do this in a year. If you're in California and you really want to start that high-speed rail boondoggle, which I don't think is a good idea, but if you wanted to do it, let's build it like we did the Big Creek Project or the California Water Project. Let's get it done in 3 years. You don't hear that. So Trump comes along and says, if they wanted an ice rink, I built it in 9 months. I can do the same thing. And people, that's a demagogic deal.
Some people are going for it. Victor Davis Hanson's latest on National Review is In Search of Fixes for a Fossilized Economy. Are you working on a book these days by any chance, Victor?
I am. I'm just finishing a history of World War II.
I will pick it up. I'm a big fan of your A War Like No Other. I know it's from some years ago, but I've talked about it before on the show.
I have a larger book on World War II that goes to the publisher in a month, so it should be out.
All right. Year. Well, please come back when it's ready to go. We'd love to talk about it. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. All right, team, phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. Much more coming. Stay with me.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Mm-hmm.
Buck Sexton.
I always think it's great to have Victor Davis Hanson on. He's a brilliant guy. His books are phenomenal, and I think it's cool to it's just cool to hear his perspective. So it was very nice of him to give us a ring. I've been reading his stuff for years and years and years, since before I was even in media. And if you, I mentioned that book, his World War II book, I'm sure is going to be phenomenal. The book, A War Like No Other, is about the Peloponnesian War between Sparta and Athens. He wrote it in about 2005. It's a really good read, a really good book. He sort of breaks it down into very digestible, the what was a long and fascinating war between the two premier powers of the sort of ancient Greek world. It's really, really cool. It's a really good book, and I would recommend it. It's also, I remember I read you once from it, specifically in reference to some of the Greek hoplites, the armor and the arms and armor the Greek hoplites would have, which is, of course, the derivation of shields high, the Greek phalanx. You have to keep your shield high, keep it at a certain level. There is the old Spartan saying, come back with your shield or on it. So it's sort of all plays into that. Come back with your shield. You could say with your shield high or on it. Same idea. So there is that. I also wanted to read you from I got two bits of cool mail here, emails, and I got a lot of them, but these are the ones that the team here in the Freedom Hut picked out. First, we have from Leilani. So let's agree that Hillary Clinton may not be indicted for her private email server debacle. Here's my question. If a Republican wins in November, can that president bring charges to Hillary Clinton, Huma, Mills, or perhaps the IRS for what they did with the conservative groups or for shredding documents? By the way, love your show and for keeping us informed 5 days a week. Shields high. God bless. Thank you so much, Leilani, first of all, from Arizona. And the answer is yes. I think the statute of limitations on most classification crimes is 10 years. And a lot of this email stuff would be 2011, 2012, around there. So, yes, an administration would have plenty of time. And the statute of limitations on treason, actually, is there is no statute of limitation. But on the Espionage Act might be a little longer for some offenses. But usually for disclosure of classified or those kinds of reckless endangerment of national security information, I think that stuff would be a 10-year statute of limitations. I know disclosure is a 10-year one. So, yes, they could bring charges. I guess the question would be, would they? There would be tremendous political pressure on them not to. And obviously the media would go into complete hyper freakout mode if you had anybody from the Obama administration charged under a Republican administration for what they did as a senior official, right? That's just, you can expect that. Does that mean that it's definitive and it couldn't happen? No, I can't tell you that. But there are clearly some very tense moments if that were to happen. But yes, theoretically, if a Republican wins, they could still bring charges. But I will tell you that they would not do it. They just won't do it. Not willing to do it. Not willing to. And at that point, by the way, think about how much time will have passed with things like the IRS targeting of the Tea Party, and the trail will have gone pretty cold by then. Bureaucrats have a good ideas, good ways how to slow down the system and how to hide stuff. This is only really works as a visual, but I have Travis from his Freedom Hut in Virginia says, "Hey Buck, Team Buck artist and liberty lover, just wanted to drop a quick portrait I did of you." He did a portrait of me, which he sent in, which maybe I'll post on Facebook or something. It's pretty cool. Thank you for that. Thank you for the portrait. I'm getting portraiture sent to me. Just like I said, who was it? John Kasich should take a portraiture so that he can find a way to cash in on his future presidency that he's never going to win, because that was why I used him as the example. So we have that. All right. I'm glad we had that discussion. I've only got about a minute and a half left. I wanted to get into something that, well, I'll start and we can kind of finish on the other side of this. How about that? Usually I like to have segments that stick within the certain, you know, we keep the show flowing and we keep it moving here, but I'm going to have to extend this one past. So there's this piece in the American Interest on college admissions that I think is very interesting. And this is this a Walter Russell Mead piece? I don't know. Walter Russell Mead certainly writes a lot for the American Interest. He's a very thoughtful guy on national security and foreign policy, more foreign policy stuff than anything else. But this piece, which I can't even find what the author is, but it is in the American Interest, says the SAT will always be unfair. And let me just give you a little bit of a read from this, and then we'll talk about it on the other side of this break. Critics have charged for years that the SAT is an elitist exam, that its emphasis on advanced vocabulary and challenging math problems favors rich kids with access to good schools and fancy tutors. So in 2014, in direct response to these concerns, the College Board announced it would overhaul the test to make it more comparable to standard high school curricula and supposedly more difficult to, quote, game with test prep courses. But with the first test date for the new SAT next month, critics are back saying that once again the test favors privileged students. And now we'll get into this New York Times report. What I want to talk to you about here is something the Democrats will never discuss, which is that they don't really want a meritocracy, but they're not willing to say that, and they don't really have an offer for what they can replace it with. But we'll get into this more on the flip side of the break. Team Buck, stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
The Buck Sexton Show.
So, team, there's this new version of the SAT that's out next month, and not very many of you I know are of SAT taking age, although I'm sure a fair number of you have SAT age taking children, or will soon have children of that age. But this is, like so many aspects of the education system, of course, this becomes very quickly a political football. And you have to do a fair amount of reading between the lines here with the New York Times to see what they're really talking about. But there's this idea, the achievement gap between different ethnicities is something that the Department of Education tracks very closely, actually. They've been tracking it for decades. And one thing that they've shown, for example, is that particularly for high school age students, the black-white achievement gap in the last 30 years has narrowed almost imperceptibly. It has been very, very small, and there are all these efforts underway constantly to find some means to narrow what they call the achievement gap as measured by standardized testing of various forms, right? Well, one of the ways, of course, that you can try to narrow the achievement gap is to change the way people assess the gap or assess the numbers, assess ability. And so the SAT becomes something of a political football because of its implications for so many things, right? Who gets to go to what school? You know, some schools have pretty hard and fast numbers for what you need to get in. Other schools, it's more GPA based. These are state schools, usually. Private schools just make it up as they go along, right? The elite institutions, colleges and universities in this country, they take it upon themselves to sort of have a holistic approach. And a lot of schools have that. Others are a little bit more by the book, by the numbers. I think the UT system, for example, there's numbers, but then they also do some diversity stuff. And this came up in the case that's before the Supreme Court, right? It's the top 10% of your school, but then there's also something else that they do. I can't even keep it all straight. Anyway, the SAT is rolling out its new test next month. It's the biggest redesign in 10 years, and it's supposed to be substantial. And here's what's interesting about this is that it has the allegation about it is that it has more words and less straightforward math. Now, you might say, okay, and I'm not a math person. I'm sure many of you listening are. My family members make fun of me even for not being a math person because I'm just avowedly not. I just can't really get excited about it. I don't like it. I don't care. I really like reading and speaking and analyzing. I just don't like numbers. I kind of wish I liked numbers because I think I would have been really cool to be an awesome surgeon or like a really good, hedge fund quant guy and make a ton of money. But anyway, I'm not a numbers guy. But nonetheless, when you look at this test and the way that people or the objections that people have, it mirrors a lot of the discussions about education and about the way that education is politicized across the country. They're essentially saying the complaint in the past was essentially that the test favors privileged kids because there's sort of little tricks you can learn, and there are these test prep organizations that some of the big ones are Kaplan, and there's others, and you take these classes, which are just preparing you to take this test, And people say, oh, well, those classes are expensive. And there really is no magic to those things, by the way. I mean, they like you to kind of think there is, but it's really just studying for a test like you'd study for any test. It's repetition and dealing with the kinds of problems that will be posed. And the more you do it, the better you get at it. So as much as it's held up as an example of income inequality playing out in the education system, yeah, there's some truth to that. But how do you get around that? Meaning that if somebody comes from a stable, comfortable home that has money for books, no matter what test you give that person versus somebody who comes from a home with a single parent who is drug addicted and there's no money for anything and they're not even sure when their next meal is coming, and there's no test that can erase that disparity. That test doesn't exist. There's no test that measures anything in terms of academic ability that could ever bridge that gap in a way that would create the kind of equality that many on the left seem to think is necessary here. So they've done this redesign in part because it's supposed to make it less about tricks, right? Sort of word game and analogy questions that they used to have on this. I'm sure some of you are having flashbacks like, oh, God, I hated the SAT. They're eliminating tricks and making it more reflective of what the average student learns in high school in their curriculum. But there are more words. And of course, now the charge is not that it's so much about the bias that comes from economic advantage and the ability to prepare for these sorts of exams. Now the charge is that, well, this, of course, discriminates against immigrants. It discriminates against people who are non-English speaking at home. The more words there are in English, obviously, the greater the advantage to native English speakers. And to that I say, yeah, that's right. There is going to be an advantage to English speakers in America on a standardized test because we speak English. That is the language in which business will be conducted. That is the prime language. It should be the official language. It annoys me every time I talk about this that it is not. It should be the official language of the United States government. But and people act like that's some sort of weird. Plenty of countries have official languages. This is we're the sort of outlier here, right? This is what I always think it's funny. Sometimes people point to the rest of the world and say, look at how advanced they are on this. We should do what they do. Lots of countries have what do you think the official language of France is? And even if it wasn't official, or it's not, even if it's not official, trust me, it might as well be. So this idea that there's not going to be any advantage to being a native English speaker or just being an English, forget about native, just being a high level English proficiency speaker. Why wouldn't we want to privilege that if we're measuring ability? See, this is where this becomes a reflection of people's broader attitudes about society. Of course, there are going to be advantages to being better at speaking English in an English speaking country. And that's reflected in your options for school. And that's going to be reflected in the job market as well. You can't eliminate that. There's no way to create a test that would measure academic ability in any meaningful way in this country that wouldn't privilege English speakers and therefore people who probably have English spoken as a first language at home over those who don't. And so this notion that the test is discriminatory, well, yes, a standardized test is in essence a form of discriminating against between one student and another, discrimination in a different sense of the term, not racial or ethnic discrimination, but to be making distinctions among people who want access to a limited number of slots in certain schools, or whether it's elite or state or whatever the case may be. But not everybody gets a trophy. This is sort of part of the society we live in now, where we're told that to sort of measure merit and ability, the only place where it seems like this hasn't taken hold yet. It's taken hold in academia. It's taken hold in media, in the workplace. It's taken hold all over this country, except on sports and the sporting field. Their ability is ability, and nobody, if you run the fastest, you win. You don't have people saying, well, at the track meet, we think little Jimmy should win, and so we're going to give him a 10-second head start because, he's shorter than the other athletes. No one's okay with that, right? If you're stepping onto that field, there are rules in place, and after that, it's may the best man or woman win. That's it. And this is true in professional sports too, by the way. No one ever says, "Oh, this team needs more diversity," whatever the sport may be. Nobody cares. They just want to see the best. Sports is the only place now where we're allowed to just say we want the best. And everyone goes, yeah, okay, who's the best? Let's put them out on the field or put them on the ice or put them on the, you know, on the track or wherever, right, on the court. Everywhere else, we have to always play these games. And with academic merit, the games become very intricate. You know, there's all these unspoken conversations, these behind closed doors conversations about the reality of how these processes work versus the way that they're put forward to the public. And the idea that standardized testing, I mean, by the way, you know, initially standardized testing was supposed to be creating this meritocratic society. You're supposed to create this meritocracy where whoever has the greatest merit will sort of excel. And it's fascinating if you read some of the older studies on sociology, and you can read, we had him on the show once, the author of The Bell Curve, whose name right now is escaping me, but I know it pretty well. We had him on the show a while ago, but he talks about how there was a time in, you know, for a long time in American history, you had people who, there was no real obvious system of advancement. And so you could have somebody with 130 IQ who is a railroad foreman or who is a police officer or who is. But what's happened over the course of the 20th and now into the 21st century is you've had a stratification of what they call a cognitive ability. In essence, people who do well on things like standardized tests, people who do well on IQ tests, which we're not really supposed to talk about anymore because IQ tests are very controversial. But stratifications into certain professions and certain places, usually correlated with financial gain, but not always. And it makes it harder and harder to sort of cling to this idea that, well, you know, if only there were standardized tests, everybody would have a shot. Well, that's true, but it's only true insofar as people have a shot that have ability, right? So now it's, you know, they promise everyone sort of upward advancement. Or advancement, rather, upward mobility as a result of taking these kinds of tests. But when certain groups excel at it, for example, as you know, there are certain groups that tend to excel on the math portion of the SAT when they break this down statistically. And that's talked about in this article, by the way. They talk about how, yes, it is true that Asian American students in the aggregate fare better on the math section of the SAT than any of their peers. Then they want to start playing these games to balance it out. Well, are you measuring math aptitude or not? You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't just say, well, there has to be some way to sort of blur these lines so it's not clear that some people or some individuals or some groups or whatever it may be are excelling, because for some to excel, it means others are left behind. And this is one of the problems that the SAT and these other ways that we sort of stratify our society, that's supposed to be the sort of meritocracy, professionally speaking, meritocracy for educational advancement and then employment. It doesn't work out the way the left wants it to, you know, because not everybody gets a trophy. And they could keep changing the rules of the game, but unless it's a game where nobody wins, this is still going to be what the outcome is. I mean, It right now is, oh, it discriminates against immigrants because there's too much English. Once we get the results in for a few years, it'll be, well, no, it discriminates against poor people because there's ways to game the test. There's always going to be ways to study and do additional work for an academic test like this. There's always going to be that. What are you going to tell people? That they're banned? What are you going to tell people? They're not allowed to be involved in these processes? They're not allowed to prepare beforehand? So, you know, this Charles Murray, by the way, is the author of The Bell Curve, and Richard Herrnstein. So, yeah, I had Charles Murray on not long ago. So this just give it some time and you'll see they're going to reshuffle the deck, and it's going to happen as it always does, that there's going to be some groups that benefit and some who don't. And it's not going to be what the left wants. The social engineers are going to be unhappy and they're going to reshuffle it again. And the only way they could make it happy is if all of a sudden the SAT became like a participation trophy, whereby you can just sort of write an essay in any language, because it shouldn't just be in English, because, you know, don't want to discriminate, and you get to grade it yourself. And then the college admissions officers can just sort of figure it out as they go. You know, it's all the whole system. It's all a game, and it's all rigged in different ways. And, you know, part of it is accepting that it's unfair and figuring out ways as best you can to maneuver within the system, because that's really what life is, too. Life is unfair, just like the SAT and income inequality for those studying. It's all there. It's always going to be unfair. So we can all sort of sit around and pretend that there's a way to change the system so that it's completely fair, or we can motivate people to do the best they can under the circumstances that they have, and winners and losers and being in the fight. That's it. Take a break here. Back in a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Discover more at theblaze.com/radio.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
I've got a little update here for you. All four of the final holdouts in that Oregon standoff at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge have surrendered, and they are in FBI custody. Earlier today, Cliven Bundy was actually arrested. He was arrested, I'm trying to see what the charges, at Portland International Airport. He faces federal charges related to the 2014 standoff at his ranch. Oh, the feds have a long memory. Interesting. They are going after him for the 2014 standoff. Bundy is 74 years old, and he is now in county jail. He was booked into county jail, I guess, last night, and they released his mugshot. But the rest of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge occupiers, the four of them have all been taken into FBI custody. And after an extended phone dialogue with supporters, he emerged. I'm trying to read this from OregonLive.com here. So the Bundy family has said on Facebook that they are safe. And what else do we have? The FBI announces it will hold a news conference. Yep. So that's all over. The Malheur Wildlife Refuge standoff. Can't think of anything that accomplished. And I'm just glad that well, there was one fatality in this, but it's good that nobody else was hurt. All right, team, if you can, join me tonight on Twitter. I'll be live tweeting the DNC debate, and obviously I'll be in the Freedom Hut with you tomorrow for 3 hours, so please do tune in. You can check out the Buck Sexton TV show at 7 Eastern tonight on the Blaze TV. Until tomorrow, my friends, shields high.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.